listening to The Existential Dostoevsky, a journey into the mind and beyond. I am your host, Jacob Michael. In this episode, I proudly present to you The Grand Inquisitor. I meant to talk about the suffering of mankind in general. You believe in God, and to you, God set it up this way. I mean, the tragedy of life. For the sake of argument, let's only dwell about the suffering of children, okay? That will reduce the scope of my argument's aim by about 10 times. I'm not going to talk about the adults. Forget the adults. They've eaten the forbidden fruit, if you will, and still go on eating it, but let's talk about the suffering of innocent children. Do I need to mention specifics? The worst of humanity? I know in Europe there was a robber who went around breaking into homes and killing the entire family. He was also known as being so evil as to slice the kids to death, and the only motive being a couple bucks, just enough to survive a little while before being caught. Can you imagine the tragedy? Do you know why I'm saying this, Alex? For some reason, I have a headache now, and I feel depressed.
Are you all right? You have a strange look on your face.
By the way, I met a Bulgarian the other day, and we got to talking on the subject, the horrors of humanity. He was telling me that the Muslim Turks, because they were afraid of a Bulgarian uprising, did all kinds of atrocities. They would rape women, and even children, nail prisoners by their ears to fence posts. You know, there's this phrase that you may be familiar with, animal cruelty, but do you know, brother, that animals are incapable of the artistic cruelty that humans can do to each other? Even hyenas, who are particularly brutal, the pack, eating a lion's cubs while they're alive, that's what it knows to do, and that's simply what it does. But think about the creativity in these people, though. The Bulgarian went on to tell me about how the Turks would cut a child out of a pregnant woman with surgical precision, and how they would toss newborn infants into the air to fall on their bayonets as if it were a ring toss. They made a point to do it in front of the mothers, too. That's ethnic rivalry. We all know how it gets when tribalism takes over and people begin to dehumanize the other. I guess that's standard fare.
What are you getting at, Adam?
I think that if the devil doesn't exist, then clearly man created him in his own likeness and image.
So, do you believe that God was created in man's image also?
Ha! You caught me! A real nice God you've got there, then. You asked me what I was getting at earlier, and I'll tell you. I've got a little hobby, collecting news headlines and stories of a specific style, if you will. Always from antiquity. The newer torturers don't have the nostalgic flair. Meh. The Bulgarian story is in it, but I have ones closer to home as well. Take this affluent couple that retired early to a mountain retreat. Had a gorgeous cottage up on the mountainside. They were reclusive, though, and no one around the small town nearby saw them but to get the usual groceries and household supplies. Everyone in town said that they were a nice, quiet, reserved couple. But no one in town even knew that the couple had a daughter. And this daughter was 5 years old. She was a victim of constant beatings. Her pale skin, it was said, had become dark as coals when they found her body from all the abuse. And it wasn't just the beatings. There were signs of other debauched abuse as well. I'll spare you the details. Keep in mind, brother, these were the girl's own parents. Her own mother doing this, going along with this. The cottage had an outhouse from earlier times, and when the authorities found the child's body locked in the outhouse, they found it there with excrement having been ingested. They have a lot of post-mortem testing. They can find this all out now. Of course, the beasts of parents had poisoned themselves and eased right out of life shortly after their child did and escaped any kind of earthly justice. Oh, look, I'm tormenting you. You have a strange look on your face. I don't mean to condescend you. I'll stop if you'd like.
No, go on. I'll suffer as well.
One more. I'll just give you one more. Remember when the English nobles would do fox hunts? Well, the Duke of a certain estate had 100 hunting dogs. He had quite a few servants, and their families would stay on the estate in the servants' quarters. This fine noble gentleman just happened to notice one day that one of his hunting dogs had a wounded paw. It was revealed to him that the culprit was a 9-year-old boy. A servant woman's child was throwing down, playing rough with the hound. So the gentleman gathered up his wolfhounds for an expedition, and he took the boy and his mother along. The group headed off into the woods, as hunting expeditions go, but when they stopped at a clearing, the Duke ordered the boy to be stripped naked for a whipping. That was his punishment. But the boy was only whipped twice when he began to run off, away into the field. The Duke noticed this, and he allowed the child to run for a distance of about an eighth of a mile. And then he yelled, "Sick!" And the dogs tore after him. And as you might expect, they tore the boy to pieces in front of his own mother's eyes. And do you know what became of the mother and the Duke? Well, the mother was immediately admitted to the asylum in town for experimental madness treatments, as you might expect. And the Duke was, eventually, after 20 years, simply found unfit to run the estate by the local magistrate. This was the community's justice. So, do you think that's fair? What should the Duke's punishment be? If you could have it for commanding dogs, what do you say?
Yes, shoot him.
Ha ha, yes, sir. Even you, a man who preaches God's forgiveness, knows that a little revenge devil is on your shoulder. That's right.
The situation is a little absurd.
Yes, absurd. And it's the world, this world, that runs on absurdities. And perhaps if there were no absurdities, the world wouldn't run at all.
Who made you the expert?
I'm not an expert in anything at all, and I don't want to be. I'm just stuck on the facts, and the facts are the facts.
Are you going to tell me the point of all this?
Of course I'll tell you. Settle in a bit. Look, I took children as an example to exaggerate the point, but God only knows how many tears have soaked the planet, how many atrocities, lives cut short, tortures endured, and I confess, I'm just a speck in a universe, and my thoughts and anecdotes aren't going to gain me any fame or significance. People are to blame, you know. We're given paradise, and look what we do with it. My point is, Alex, I don't accept God. If this is the world he made, and this type of suffering is the price of admission, then I respectfully return him the ticket.
That's not right.
How so? Look, imagine yourself as the grand architect, and for you to create this noble creature with free will, all you had to do was let that one little girl found in the outhouse go through that suffering. You had to allow it, because you wanted to give people the choice, the freedom of choice, to be good or to be evil. You simply can't have it both ways in your Bible. You have to allow these evils to happen, or you just create benign robots who aren't capable of such things. But then they would never be capable of great love either. Neither capable of laying down their lives for their countrymen, or to rescue children from such horrors that the ethnic cleansers commit. Would you agree to allow the horrors to happen just so that some love of neighbor somewhere could be developed?
I don't suppose so. No, I couldn't do it. But there is an innocent one who could forgive and make things right. And he began his work when he gave his life for all.
Ah! About time. You religious types are always trotting him out right away. Front and center. I'm shocked you haven't mentioned him already. What took you so long, Alex? Believe me, I haven't forgotten about him. In fact, I wanted to share a novel I wrote just about that.
You wrote a novel?
Yes and no. Not so much a novel, but more like a short story. The format is irrelevant. The fact of the matter is, I didn't even write it yet. It's completely memorized. You want to hear it?
Go ahead.
The name of my novel is The Grand Inquisitor. And hey, it's absurd, but I'd still like you to hear it. My story needs some background, a preface, if you will. The story takes place in the 1500s in Europe, namely Seville, Spain. It's where the Inquisitions took place. I'm sure you've heard of them. What they did was burn people at the stake who weren't Catholic. It's a historical fact. And around that time, they would also have stories and plays where saints would come down from heaven and do miraculous stuff. also historical fact. There was Dante's Inferno, which I'm sure you're familiar with. There was also a French play, Le Bon Jugement, of the Virgin Mary. It's kind of similar to Dante, except she goes to hell, sees the tormented, prays for them, so they get like a day off every year, a day from the torments, that is. Now, this is all silly to our modern sensibilities, but you see, just look at like the superhero movies now. Religion had a lot of entertainment built into it, and that's kind of what I'm building off of, fantasy and historical event. So, 15 centuries have gone by since the faithful have heard from Christ. 15 centuries since the big event. Since then, nothing. Man hasn't heard a thing from God. No big fireworks from heaven, mass miraculous events, no fire from the sky, no return of Christ, nothing. Same as today, right? Oh, but how the dedicated cling to this story. People love their religion, right? Anyways, put yourself in Spain. Smell the infidels burning. Every day a new non-believer or a believer of the wrong type. Up in flames. I mean, you can smell it. The old cities were like that, and the smell alone creeping through the alleys, no one can hide from it. And that was the news, brother. That was the social media proclamation. That was the Twitter, warning all the good citizens what stepping out of line meant. The scent carries a message to all corners of the city. I suspect that's why they did burning, you know? It's more effective that way. Anyone can avoid the executioner square by trotting around the next block, but in the hot summer, no one can get away from that smell, no matter what block you're on. The smell of burning human flesh. And this is the scene to which he steps on.
He?
Jesus Christ, he. But not the way you would like to think. I mean, not in the way he promised in the Bible 15 centuries before, in his return, his glorious return on a cloud, riding a white horse, pronouncing his judgment, separating the righteous from the wicked, the good from the evil, for heaven or hell. No, not like that. He comes just for a visit, like he came once before, the same way, the suffering servant, humble, joyful, quiet, meek. He began healing people, and because of it, he was drawing crowds. Now, I'm not going to go so far as to rewrite the story. There's no disciples, no Christmas story with shepherds. That's already been written. I'm not making a contemporary gospel story the way an evangelical Hollywood Left Behind type of thing. No, that's not what I'm getting at all. Just follow along with me. It's just a short story where he comes back in the same manner he was here before 2,000 years ago. The humble teacher in his 30s, healing people and telling them to play nice. So he's walking through the city streets, and he's starting to draw crowds. He's starting to bring attention to himself the way he did before, just by being him. A woman comes up to him, weeping, crying her eyes out, pleading emphatically. You know how the religious do, really turning on the waterworks. Well, she's got some reason to. Her daughter died recently, and the husband is following close behind, carrying the dead girl's corpse. I know it sounds weird, but people really did this back then. Anyways, she's begging him to raise the dead. And he does. Bam. Miracle. He's doing all the other stuff too. People who are crippled are told to walk. And they walk. It's a big show. Here's the thing. The bishop, the cardinal, the high-ranking religious leader catches wind of this. No pun intended. I mean, we're already catching wind of burning bodies, right? So he heads out into the streets with his entourage of other well-dressed, funny hat mini popes. Right? And he knows exactly what he's looking for, the direction they are heading at the moment the dead girl is risen up and the crowd goes into a fever pitch like at a modern ball game. The Grand Inquisitor, that's what we'll call him, the religious leader, the Grand Inquisitor turns the corner and steps out into the city square with his gang of robed minions. He's a real old man, about 90, with a sagging face and eyes that look hollow. But what's odd is he still displays authority and composure despite his relic-like age. I met a guy in a bar last week, kind of reminded me of this character. 78, but still kicking ass. I mean, he had a nice little pitcher of beer there. He spoke clearly. I couldn't believe it. But you know, some people live longer nowadays. Well, to be honest, to be fair, I have my suspicion that some people live long back in the days too. There's evidence to support this, I believe. Everyone seems to count the average lifespan, but if you factor in infant mortality rates, which are much, much higher, then it takes the whole thing down. So that's why I believe this 90-year-old bishop is still kicking ass and burning the non-believers at the stake, right? Follow me now. He scowls at the scene, shows obvious displeasure at the bringing back to life of the dead girl, even though if we were to see this, it would melt the heart of the most hardened. This sweet little girl brought back from the dead, rosy cheeks, smiling, bright-eyed, magical. Not to this guy, though. He scowls. He points his old scaly finger at him and orders his armed guards to seize the man. Because you do really realize that the religious and the state authority were one at this time. Don't forget that. There was no rebellion, no independence, no thought of rights or fair trials, separation of church and state, none of that. Just don't mess with the king or the bishop. That's how things were. So they seize him. Without so much as a peep from the crowd, they are cowed in silence and submissive fear. The bishop and his entourage, now with prisoner in tow, walk silently past the crowd, and some even bow to the man as he makes the sign of the cross over them in an eerie, silent blessing. This is how it is. Cut scene. The dungeon. The night has fallen. Torches glow in the distant chambers. He is there. He, being himself, remains silent and meek. He just sits quietly in his dungeon chamber amidst the smell of burning flesh outdoors creeping through that hot summer air. You see, the knights in Seville give no reprieve from the heat. It's everywhere. Granted, the dungeon's stone walls may be a little cooler, and maybe he sits on the floor and leans back against them, but he is silent. Always silent. Then, suddenly, the iron door to his cage squeaks open. It's like a horror movie. It's the entrance of the Grand Inquisitor, the old man. His lantern throws his shadow into the cell before he even enters. The bishop stands tall over him, who is gently seated on the prison floor. The bishop's guards bring in a chair and a small table where he promptly takes a seat and sets his lantern down. He signals the guards to leave, and the iron door clanks and locks. The bishop stares at him, looking down at him. A good 2 minutes goes by like this, and then silence and the flickering lantern are finally interrupted by the bishop, the Grand Inquisitor. Can it be you? Are you he? Don't answer. I know exactly what you would say, and you have no right to add to what you have said once before. Why then have you come? Are you here to interfere? You are, and you know it. But do you know what will happen tomorrow? I do not know who you are, and I do not want to know, but regardless, tomorrow I will sentence you, and you will be burned at the stake as an evil man. And do you know that the same crowds, those same people who rushed up just to touch the hem of your garment, the crowds that gathered around you, they will rush to pile the wood up at your feet and watch you burn. Do you know that? Yes. Perhaps you do know it.
I don't understand what this is, Ivan. Wild rhetoric. Or a case of mistaken identity. Or what?
Assume it's the latter, if you like. If you're so ruined by postmodern science and politics, just assume it's mistaken identity. Whatever. Take it as we would read it now, if you would. I mean, the guy is 90. He might have lost his marbles a long time ago over his ideology and loony religion, but isn't it all the same either way? The point is, the old man needs to have this monologue. He needs to say what he's believed all these years as the community's head religious leader.
And Jesus, the prisoner, whoever he is, just sits there and doesn't say anything?
That's the way it's got to be, though. The old man points out that he doesn't have the right to add to what has already been said once, right? I mean, that's the most basic tenet of Christianity, especially Catholics, at least. That's the way I see it. If you're adding something new, it's a cult and not the same religion. The entire thing changes. You don't have the Bible anymore. Anyways, the Grand Inquisitor continues his inquiry. Do you have the right to pronounce to us even one of the mysteries of heaven? No, you don't. Because you can't add to what has already been said once. Anything you proclaim anew will encroach on faith and the freedom to believe. If you show up spelling it all out, then you will lose the thing most dearest to you, men's faith. That's what you want from them. You want them to choose to love that which they do not see. You want to throw hints from the past, hints from afar, and have their undying devotion. Am I not right? Wasn't it you who said, I will set you free? Ah, yes. Yes, your work has set us back, but we have finally finished our work, and we have done it all in your holy name. For 1500 years, we've been agonizing over this freedom of yours, but now it's finished, and finished well, if I do say so myself. You don't believe it is done? You look outside through the hole in your cell wall, and you think maybe we are not finished with our work? Right now, you are just sitting there, looking at me, meekly, and you wouldn't even dare to be enraged at the words I am saying. So know this, precisely now, these people out there are more convinced than ever before that they are completely free, and at the same time, it is they who brought their freedom and laid it right down at our feet. It is our doing.
I don't understand. Is he being ironic? Is he mocking him?
Not at all. He takes full credit for him and his church officials overcoming freedom itself. You see, the old man is pretty spry. He's getting excited, gloating all over himself, and he's about to jump into a long diatribe. Check it out. He says this. Only now has it become possible to think about human happiness. Man was made a rebel. But can the rebellious be truly happy? You were warned, but you didn't heed the warning signs. Did you? You rejected the only way to make humans happy, the only way of organizing it. But fortunately, you handed the responsibility over to us. You yourself established with your words the right of the church to bind and loose. You gave us that power, and we've kept it. Surely you can't think of taking it away from us now. Why then have you come to interfere?
What does it mean? He had no lack of warning. What's that all about?
Well, that's the main thing. The Grand Inquisitor needs to talk about. So just follow me now. He goes on to say, very eloquently, I might add, he says this. The dreadful intelligent spirit, the spirit of destruction and non-being, the great spirit who spoke to you in the desert after 40 days and 40 nights. It's been passed on to us in the Bible that he tempted you. Did he really? And was it possible to say anything truer than what the devil said to you in his three temptations which you rejected and which the Bible refers to as temptations? And at the same time, if ever a real miracle, a real public miracle happened on earth, it was on that day, the day of those three temptations. The miracle lay exactly in the appearance of those three questions. Do you think that all the combined wisdom of the world could come up with anything even remotely resembling the force and the depth of those three questions the devil put to you in the desert? By those questions alone, one can infer we're not dealing with mere mortals here, but something greater. For in these three questions, all of history is brought together and foretold. Three images are revealed that will take in all the contradictions of human nature. This couldn't have been seen so well at the time, but now that 15 centuries have gone by, we can see how perfect and absolute these questions in fact were. Decide for yourself who is right, you or the devil who questioned you. Recall the first question. Its meaning was, though not literally this, you want to go into the world with only some promise of man's freedom, which mankind in their lawlessness cannot even comprehend. No, they dread and fear it. Nothing has been more insufferable for people in society as a whole than freedom. But do you see these stones in the hot, barren desert? Turn them to bread, and the people will run after you like sheep. They will be grateful and obedient, yet eternally trembling, lest you withdraw your hand and the bread turns back to rock. But you did not want to deprive man of freedom, and you rejected the offer. For what sort of freedom is it if obedience is bought with bread? You objected that man does not live by bread alone. But do you know that in the name of this very bread that the Zeitgeist will rise up against you and fight with you and defeat you, and all the people will follow it, saying, who is greater than this beast who has shown us miracles? Do you know that centuries will pass and men with their science and facts will shout from the rooftops that there is no crime and therefore no sin, but only the hungry poor acting out of desperation? Feed them first, then ask good behavior of them. They will write that on the banner they raise up against you. No science will give them bread as long as they remain free. But in the end, they will lay their freedom at our feet and say to us, we don't care if you enslave us, just feed us. Then they will finally understand, as thou knowest, that freedom and bread in plenty for everyone cannot exist together. for never, never will they be able to share among themselves. They will also be convinced that they are forever incapable of being free, because they are weak, depraved, nobodies, and rebels. You promised them heavenly bread, but I repeat again, can it compare with the earthly bread in the eyes of the weak and eternally depraved human race? And in the name of heavenly bread, thousands will follow you. But what will become of the millions of millions who will not be strong enough to forego earthly bread for the sake of the heavenly? Is it that only the handful of strong-minded saints are dear to you, and the remaining millions of weak that love you should serve only as fodder for the mighty? But the weak are dear to us. They are depraved and rebels, but in the end it is they who will become obedient. They will look at us as gods because we have decided to bear the burden of freedom, and suffering from it, we will rule over them. In the end, the most terrible thing for them is to be free, but we will attribute this to you and rule in your name. This great deceit is what constitutes our suffering. We have to lie. This is what the first question in the desert meant, and this is what you rejected. All in the name of freedom. You place freedom as the foundation of everything, which leads right into the second temptation. Is it not true? As soon as man is free, there is no more important aim than to rush and find himself something to bow down to. But man looks to bow down to that which is undeniable, and so undeniable that all other people will at once join him in worshiping it. It's not just that one needs something greater than himself to bow to, it's that he is driven to make sure it is universal, and that all other men bow down to it as well. And that's the main torment from the beginning of time. Man needs universality to know that all other men bow down to the ultimate as he does. For this cause, from the beginning of time, all wars fought began with, "Bow down to our gods, or we will destroy you and your gods." It will be this way until the end of time. Even after they are past the mythical gods, it will be their idea of the way culture should behave, or it will be their opinion on how to respond to the science of the age. It will be whether they view a behavior as moral, acceptable, or repulsive. Bow to our idea, or death to you and your idea. And you knew this. This essential makeup of human nature, but you rejected raising the banner that at once would solve it and make all men bow down to you, undisputed. The banner of bread for all, and you rejected it in the name of heavenly bread and of freedom. I'll tell you this, nothing torments mankind more than to find someone as quickly as possible to shove off his weight of freedom onto, miserable creature that he is. Ah, but only one who can soothe the conscience can subdue the freedom of man. Bread is an indisputable banner, is it not? But if, at the same time, someone else, say, seduced his conscience away from you, he will at once throw down his bread and out of moral indignation follow the one who has taken over his conscience so. In this you are correct, for the mystery of being is not just in living, but what one lives for. Without a firm idea of what man lives for, he will not consent to go on living at all, even if he has all the bread he could ever want or need. What came of this so-called temptation, then? Instead of taking away the burden of man's freedom, you increased it. Don't you know that nothing is more dear to them than peace and even death compared to this tormenting and haunting freedom of the knowledge of good and evil? So instead of a nice appeasement of conscience, you chose everything that was enigmatic and beyond their strength. Therefore, you acted as if you did not love them at all. The one who came to give his life for the many did not take away the chief torment of mankind, namely freedom, but rather increased it and burdened the soul with its torments. You wanted mankind to love you freely, wooed and captivated by you, instead of the hard-bound law of old. So man would have to decide between good and evil, having only an image of you to guide him. But did it ever occur to you that he would eventually reject your image and your truth if he were oppressed by such a burden as freedom of choice? Yes, they will finally announce that the truth is not with you because you abandoned them to so many cares, woes, and impossible choices. Thus you, yourself, lay the foundation of the kingdom that is falling and will fall once our work is complete. There are only three powers in this world capable of holding man's conscience: miracle, mystery, and authority. You rejected all three, and you gave yourself as an example of this. When the dreadful and wise old spirit took you down to the top of the city wall and whispered to you, "Throw yourself down, for it is written, his angels will bear you up lest you fall, and prove you are truly the son of the Most High God," you heard and rejected the offer, and you did not throw yourself down. Ah, of course you acted so magnificently as a god, but mankind, are they gods too? Oh, you knew then if you had made just one step toward the ledge to throw yourself off the building that you would have lost all faith in the Lord and the devil would rejoice. But, back to my point, how many are like you? Could you think that all people could choose as you did and resist this temptation? In those terrible moments of life, when it all comes crashing down, was man created to respond so eloquently as you have? To reject diving for the miracle in his darkest hour? You left him with only the free choice to follow you as you have done, and you hoped he would have no need of miracles and remain with God in faith. No, don't you know that as soon as man rejects miracles, he will reject God as well? And since he cannot bear to be left without miracles, he will go and invent new miracles on his own. He will run to the miracles of sorcerers and hacks, even if he knows this to be a betrayal of his own religion. You did not come down from the cross when the mockers reviled you. Take yourself down off that cross if you are truly the Son of God. You did not come down because you did not want to enslave men by a miracle, and you wanted a faith that is free, not miraculous. You wanted a love that was free, not the raptures of a terrified slave. But here too, you overestimated mankind. Of course they are in fact slaves, though they were born rebels. Behold and judge, 15 centuries later, and I swear to you they are weaker and more debased than you thought. How can mankind ever accomplish the same things as you? You respect them in such a way, it's as if you had ceased to be compassionate, because you have demanded too much of them. If you would have respected them less, you would have demanded less from them, and you who gave your life for them. That would have been closer to love, because their burden would be lighter. People are weak and not so lofty-minded. What a matter we have got in our hands, that even now they rebel. They take pride in this rebellion, the rebellion of a child and a schoolboy. They are as children who rebel in class and drive out the teacher. Ah, but even their bit of fun will soon come to an end, and in the end they will see it has cost them dearly. They will have drenched the earth in blood, and only then will they realize they are feeble, and they will come to us, and they will acknowledge that he who created them also intended to laugh at them. Then they will turn to blasphemy, and in their blasphemy will become even more unhappy, for man cannot abide blasphemy for long. And so, turmoil, confusion, unhappiness, all the present lot of mankind, and this, after you suffered so much for their freedom. Your Revelations prophet tells the story of his vision of a tribe of 12,000 resurrected, but even if it were so many, they also were not like men, but gods. They endured your cross and ate locusts and wild honey in the desert. And of course, you can point to these with pride, your holy ones, who sacrificed so much for your name. But what of the others? What about the rest? Is it their fault the rest of mankind could not endure the lot of your enlightened few? Is it the fault of the weak soul that she cannot bear your cross? Can it be that you only came for a few, a handful of the mighty in spirit? If that's the case, there is a mystery here. There is a mystery and we cannot grasp it. But if it is a mystery, then we too have the right to preach to them that it is not the free choice of the heart and not love that matters, but the mystery which they must blindly obey, setting aside even their own conscience. And so we did just that. We corrected your deed and based it on miracle, mystery, and authority. And mankind rejoiced that they were once again as sheep, and they were happy that such a terribly weighty burden was relieved of them. Tell me, were we right in doing so? Have we not loved mankind so much as to recognize their impotence and spirit and leave the feeble nature to us? We even allow them to sin with our permission. Why have you come to interfere with us now? And why are you looking at me with your meek and understanding eyes? Be angry! I do not want your love, for I do not love you. And what can I hide from you? Do I not know with whom I am speaking? What I am telling to you is known to you already. I can see it in your eyes. Is it for me to hide our plans from you? Perhaps you only wanted me to say it. Well, listen then. We are not with you. We are with him. That is our secret. For a long time now, 8 centuries to be exact, we have not been with you, but with him. It was the middle of the 8th century we took what you had refused from the wise serpent. You indignantly rejected his last offer in the desert, the sword of Caesar. We proclaimed ourselves sole rulers of the earth, though we have not yet completed our task. This work is still in its beginnings, but it has begun, make no mistake. We shall be Caesars. Then we shall think about the universal happiness of mankind. You could have taken the sword then, but you didn't. Why did you reject this last gift offered by the wise serpent? Had you accepted it, you could have satisfied man with all he seeks on earth, namely, someone to bow down to, someone to captivate his conscience, and a means for uniting everyone into the harmonious, productive anthill. The need for universality has always been the chief concern of mankind. There have been many nations through the histories who have risen to great stature, yet the higher they rose, the less happy their populace, for they were made more painfully aware of this need for universality. Much more than others waiting to be tamed. Great conquerors, Alexanders and Genghis Khans, swept over the earth like a whirlwind, yearning to conquer the universe. But they too only expressed this great need of man for universal union under one banner. Had you accepted and donned Caesar's purple, you would have founded a universal kingdom, and with it established peace. For who will claim possession of all mankind but those who have captured their conscience and gave them their bread? So we took Caesar's sword, and in taking it rejected you and your way, and now we follow him. Oh, make no mistake, there will still be centuries more of the lawlessness of free reason, science, and cannibalism, for they have begun to build their Tower of Babel without us. They will surely end in cannibalism. And it is then they will come crawling back to us. Then and only then will peace and happiness reign over the earth. You are proud of your saints. Yet you only have your saints, while we have the whole world. And still yet, how many among those saints, the strong ones and those who might have become saints, how many among them will grow tired of waiting for you? They will come to their senses and sow in another field, our field. They will end by raising their banner of freedom against you. With us, everyone will be happy. They will no longer rebel or destroy each other as your freedom everywhere would have it. We will have convinced them that they will only be free after they have resigned their freedom to us. Will we be right or will we be lying? Decide for yourself. They themselves will testify that we are right, for they will remember to what ends your freedom has led them. Freedom, reason, and their science will lead them into such a maze of insoluble mysteries that they will extinguish their lives and they will war against each other, killing each other over their idea. And those who survive will see the light. Yes, they will come to us. They will come to us on their knees saying, "You were right. Only you can possess the wisdom of such mystery as to rule over us. We bow at your feet. We kiss the ring." Receiving bread from us, they will see that we take it from those who produce, and we redistribute it fairly, without any miracle at all. They will see that we have not turned stones into bread, and they will rejoice thankfully, taking it from our hands. For they will remember all too well how even the bread they harvested for themselves had turned to stones in their own hands. And when they came to us, those stones turned right back into bread. They will appreciate what it means to submit once and for all, and until they understand this, all mankind will be most unhappy. Who contributed most of all to their lack of understanding? Tell me, who broke up the flock and scattered them to paths unknown? But the flock will gather again and at once submit, and at this time it will be final. Then we shall give them happiness, the happiness of the quiet and the humble, feeble creatures that they are. Oh, we shall finally convince them to be humble, for it was you who taught them to be proud, for you raised them up. We will prove to them that they are feeble little children, for a child's happiness is sweeter than any other. They will become timid and look to us in fear, as chicks to a mother hen. They will stand in awe of us, that we are so powerful and so intelligent as to be able to subdue the flock of millions upon millions among the face of the earth. They will tremble before our wrath. Their minds will grow timid as a child once more. They will pass along the hours in joy and laughter, for we will arrange it for them. Yes, they will work, and they will have their allotted hours for work, and we shall also appoint their hours of leisure, for it is us who brings them back to this simplicity and innocence. We will allow them to sin, too. They are weak and powerless, and they will love us like children for allowing them to sin. We will tell them that every sin will be forgiven if it is committed with our permission, and we will allow them to sin because we love them. As for punishment for these sins, we will take it upon ourselves, and they will adore us as benefactors for taking it upon ourselves to be punished for their sins before God. And they will keep no secret from us. We will allow them to lie with their wives or their mistresses, to have or to not have children, and they will submit to this joyfully. The most tormenting secrets of their conscience they will bear unto us with joy and gladness, for it will deliver them from the woe of their personal and free decision. All responsibility will be ours to bear so long as they are obedient, and everyone will be happy and at peace. The great millions will be joyful and carefree, except for us who govern them. For only we who keep the mystery, only we shall bear unhappiness. There will be thousands of millions of happy children, and only we, the select few, shall suffer the knowledge of good and evil. Peacefully they will die, and peacefully they will breathe their last in your name. And beyond the grave, they will only find death. But we will keep the secret and entice them with a heavenly and eternal reward. For even if there were an afterlife, it would not be for them. It is written and prophesied that you will come once again, and you will return in victory, your saints along with you, your proud and mighty saints. But we will come to you and say to you that those saints only saved themselves, while we have saved everyone. It is said in Revelation 17 that the harlot will be disgraced and the feeble will rebel again. But then I will stand up to you, and I will point out to you the thousands of millions taken up under our care, who do not know sin. And then we, who took upon ourselves the punishment for their sins so that they may be happy, we will stand before you and say, judge us if you can and if you dare. Know that I am not afraid of you. Know that I too was in the desert eating locusts and honey. There was a time when I too blessed freedom, the freedom with which you have blessed mankind. And I too was preparing to enter among the saints. I desired and thirsted that I may be counted among that number, and that that number would be filled. But I awoke, and I did not want to serve madness. I returned from the desert, and I joined with those who have corrected your deed, and are correcting it as we speak. I left the proud, and I returned to the humble, for this happiness of the humble, this mystery I speak of, will come true, and our kingdom shall be established. I'll show you. Tomorrow on the morn, this obedient flock, at my first gesture, will rush to heap the coals up at your feet, and I shall burn you for coming to interfere with us. If anyone has ever deserved our stake, it is you. Tomorrow, I shall burn you. It is decided.
But that's absurd. Your novel praises Jesus. It doesn't condemn him, as I am sure you meant it to. And who's going to believe you about freedom? Is that any way to see it? It's a far cry from the Orthodox idea. It's Rome, and not even the whole of Rome. It's the Jesuits. They're the worst of the Catholics. There couldn't possibly be a person like your Inquisitor. What sins do they take upon themselves? Who are these bearers of mystery who take some kind of curse upon themselves for the happiness of all? We know the Jesuits. Bad things are said about them. But they're not that. Not that at all. They're just a Roman army of a future world government with the Pope at their head. That's their ideal. But without any mystery or lofty sadness, there's no secret to it. It's just the lust of power. Your suffering Inquisitor is only a fantasy.
Wait, don't get so worked up. A fantasy? Of course it's a fantasy, but still. Do you really think that this whole Catholic movement of the past few centuries is really nothing but the lust for power for its own sake? Did Father Piusy teach you that?
No, actually he said something like what you said, but not the same, not at all the same.
Oh, look, he admits it. Albeit you're not the same thing. So I'll ask you specifically, why should your Jesuits and Inquisitors conspire only for the love of power? Why can't there be even one among them who is motivated by the injustice in the world and a great love for mankind? Okay, let's say that one, just one, among all the rest that simply desire power, just one is like my Grand Inquisitor, who, as you'll recall, went out into the desert and ate only locusts and wild honey in order to save his soul, but who at the same time loved all people his whole life. Say he suddenly opened his eyes and saw that there was no great moral blessedness in overcoming the desires of the flesh, only at the same time to see that millions of others had been set up by God for mockery. Most people can't even manage a diet, let alone manage choices of morality, good and evil. He realized that from such people, universal peace and happiness could never be attained. So he comes to his senses, and he returns to the world. Then he joins with certain other intelligent people. Can't that have happened?
What intelligent people? They're not that smart. They don't have any great mysteries or secrets. Except they don't believe in God. That's the whole thing. Your Inquisitor doesn't believe in God.
And so what? Now you get it. That's the whole secret. But think about this. If he wasted his time trying to save his soul in the desert, only to realize he has an undying desire to save the world, is that not tragic? In the end, he concludes that only the words of the devil hold the wisdom to save the world, and only the devil's advice could organize people in such a way as to bring about universal happiness. And so convinced of that, he realizes he must follow the devil's directive and to that end, commit to lying and deceiving people, so that having lied to all these people, he leads them away from God, who he used to believe in, straight into the ideals of Satan himself. And he's doing this for their happiness. Is that not a tragedy? How is it not possible that this old man could be at the head of the Catholic Church at one point or another, or at the head of some Illuminati, or as you say, Jesuits, an army of Rome? My guess is that the Masons may have some underlying philosophy like this at their basis, and that the Catholics hate Masons because they see them as competitors to the same philosophy. However, the way I am defending it now makes it sound like my story hasn't held up to your criticism. Forget about that.
Well, maybe you're a Mason yourself. You don't believe in God. So, how does your novel end? Or was that the end?
Well, I was going to end it like this. After the Inquisitor had finished his long speech, he sat there and he waited for a reply from his prisoner. He had noticed how the whole time he just sat there listening, never breaking eye contact, and apparently not wanting to interrupt or challenge him on anything he said. The old man wished he would have said something, even something terrible, but he never did. And after a few moments, just when the silence was getting too uncomfortable, he rushes up to the old man and embraces him with a firm hug. That's his only reply. The old man had never been held so deeply and honestly. He was moved, but would not allow tears, as they would have begun to fall had he not pushed the prisoner away immediately. He calls for the guards. The door flings open and he gestures to the prisoner. Go! And go immediately. And so he does. He is released into the night, never to be seen or heard from again.
And the Inquisitor?
The hug touches him to the core, but he holds to his former idea. Nothing changes for him.
And you too.
But it's nonsense, Alex. It's just a confused novel written by a confused student who never wrote two lines of a poem. Why are you taking it so seriously? You don't think I'll go off to the Jesuits now and join with those who are correcting his work, do you? Good Lord, who cares? As I told you, I only want to drag on until I hit 30. Then I'll sit in the garage with the car on.
And the great outdoors and the woman you love. I know you. You're going to be a part of some atheist group, some kind of socialist campus club. You won't have it any other way.
There is a force that will have everything.
What force?
The force of our family name, of hedonism and partying like Dad, our entire lives growing up.
So, to drink away your sorrows, Party until you're numb. Is that it?
At least until my 30th birthday. I'm not planning on living any longer. But who knows? Maybe I won't turn out like Dad.
By what means, though?
By the same means he came to be like he is. I don't know.
You mean like your relativist philosophy? Everything is permitted? Is that it?
You caught my little jab at our buddy Mike the other day. Yes, but since you mention it, something of the sort. I like how our brother phrased it a little better, but yeah, everything is permissible. Are you going to judge me for that? Are you going to disown me? Plagiarism! You stole that from my novel! Thanks for the hug, though. I think we should both be going now. All right, so, Jason, this is your first time hearing this story. Never read it before. So we're here, and I'm thinking maybe I can get some impressions from you on this. That was a great job. I got to hand it to you, and I think our audience is going to be super impressed. All you did was read that script, and you had never, ever seen this piece of paper or this story before. So I am thrilled, and you did a really great job. So everyone's going to be really impressed and is going to want your phone number. You're going to have a fan club here pretty soon.
That's probably a little bit of a stretch. But thank you.
So I'm just curious. I want to kind of find out, like, what are your general impressions of this story? What did you think about the idea of, well, okay, so we'll start at the beginning. Rebellion is really, we went to the first chapter before the Grand Inquisitor, and we did Rebellion. What did you think of Ivan, the main character? What did you think of his take on the suffering of humans and how it's not okay that God allows this, that God is not good, maybe that God is the devil?
Yeah, I was pretty impressed with, you know, the approach of the story in of itself. You know, it actually correlates well with, you know, a lot of things that you can see around the world today. And the responsibilities that leaders take on, and how that can lead to all the conflicts that we have, you know, just as human beings, as well as, you know, trying to come up with answers to how do we make the world better, especially as a, you know, being raised in a religious household myself, you know, we were always thinking of the afterlife and heaven, and you want that here on earth as you look out and see all the suffering and everything. But you know, it's right, freedom's destructive if it's lost.
Yeah, well, in the freedom of choice can lead to bad things as well as it can lead to good things. So, yeah. You know, and if you abstract that, and I think the Inquisitor's main idea was to get rid of that altogether so that people could be happy and peaceful, you know.
But that's impossible.
Yeah, right? That's not reality we're dealing with. And that was what the way the Inquisitor wanted to shape the world. I think that's relevant today, too, because there's a lot of folks that want to shape the world that way, you know. They want to limit our choice so much that you don't have a choice to where you would be able to commit evil. But at the same time, if you don't have that choice, you also can't commit good. And I guess Ivan's take is that it's not all worth it. He wants to return God the ticket because that suffering of children is just not worth it, just for some lofty ideal of freedom. I mean, how do you feel about that? Do you think that freedom is worth it?
Freedom is always worth it. Personal responsibility is key to living any type of and finding any type of you know, fulfillment in your life. You can't give yourself completely in that way. You have to maintain that personal choice, that personal freedom, personal responsibility. You have to act in your own best interest, with the intent of not causing problems for other people.
Right. Yeah. And there's people out there too that would disagree with you and would say that, hey, I don't want responsibility. I just want to sit back on a beach, drink a margarita, not have to worry about all this stuff. I mean, what do you think about that argument? And there's people out there that, you know, that's an argument.
Everything in moderation, I guess. You know, there is times to go to the beach and drink a margarita.
Understood.
Most of the people that turn that into their lifestyle, I don't think it's their frustration with acting out and playing a role when they are around other people. It becomes a trap. You have to make time for yourself. You have to make time for others.
It's interesting that you phrase it that way, because the existentialist school of philosophy, which Dostoevsky is known so well for being a part of, one of the founding treatises, one of the founding themes of it, it's a pretty loose philosophy, but one of the main things is, you know, Shakespeare's "To thine own self be true." And that authenticity, you know, it's funny that you mentioned, like, you know, you're maintaining this facade in the world and you need to break from it and et cetera, because they have so many expectations of you. And the idea of existentialism, and even this book, you look at the main character, I know you haven't read it, but if you look at Alyosha, who I named Alex in this to make it more easy to read, but if you look at him throughout the whole thing, he stays true to himself. And that's what's important. And I think, I'm not so sure what happens to Ivan's character. I mean, he goes crazy. He goes crazy because he can't accept this world that, for lack of better terms, that God set up in a certain way. You know, even though he doesn't believe in God, he doesn't accept the world as it is and doesn't accept the fact that there's a force behind this that is allowing this to happen, you know? So I think it's pretty important that you touched on authenticity, because that touches the theme of the show. This is the existential Dostoevsky. So we get into that philosophy quite a bit. And there's other existential thinkers that will, religious and non-religious, that will both say the most important thing is in your life, to living a fulfilled life, is responsibility, meaning, and being true to yourself. You know, and here you have the Grand Inquisitor, who wants to take those three things and relegate them and basically just make you a happy, you know, obedient child, basically. It's the ultimate, like, you know, patriarchal attitude where, you know, you're just taking care of children. You're not giving people the respect. I thought it was interesting, and what, I don't know what you think of this. He condemns Christ, and he says that if you wouldn't have respected them so much, they would be happier. If you wouldn't have respected their freedom of choice and their ability to be responsible for their own life so much, they would be happy. How can you call this love? How can you call this compassionate? You know, and I think that's Ivan speaking himself through the Inquisitor right there. You know, I don't know. What'd you think about that?
Yeah, that's interesting. But I kind of see it like, as if you look at a smaller level, say a family unit, you know, the different levels that a parent goes through as their child gets older, as much as you want them to stay young and innocent and have control of their lives, your grand goal of being a good parent is to get them to a level to where they don't need you. And so it's almost like with the Grand Inquisitor, he's doing a reverse parenting role, because he wants to lock them in as children when they're not. They're ultimately need to become adults, need to become responsible, self-sufficient, and be able to care for themselves on their own. But in modern society, we've removed so much of that responsibility. There's no, you don't have to hunt for yourself. You don't have to farm for yourself. You don't have to so many basics of life are just automatically done for you. And that has made society in a lot of ways very evil and broke. And yeah, we're seeing the problems with it today, you know, unless you fit into a niche. Well, that's not freedom.
Right, like an ideological niche. You know, there's like these ideological tribes. I'm a liberal, I'm a conservative. Those are the big ones right now, you know. And, you know, this it's interesting too, because if you read some of Dostoevsky's other works, he always warns of these ideological tribes, of these people who just blindly follow ideologies because it's a tribe they can fit in with. And in that, you're not being true to yourself. You know, you go to this tribe, these two tribes in the United States right now can't hold all the values of every single person in one. You know what I mean? There's some things, you know, like if you're going to go, let's say, for example, the Democrat way, well, you may disagree on gun control or something like that. And you'll find that like people everywhere have all these varying opinions. But you'll also find people that do have those varying opinions that will lie to themselves and will be dishonest about those varying opinions in order to stay in that club or to make sure that the other club isn't empowered. You understand what I'm saying? They'll suppress their own, you know, sense of freedom, responsibility. They'll suppress their own opinion and surrender that to one specific club out of fear that the other club will rise and they won't get their ultimate goal. We see this a lot as union workers. I mean, I don't want to get too political, but, you know, our goal is to make sure that we have a certain amount of bread on our table. And we, you know, implore certain...
We get a respectable piece of the pie for...
Exactly.
The time we put in.
Exactly. So we implore one party for that. But at the same time, that other party doesn't represent other interests that we as workers have in our mind. You know, they oppose some interests that we are very, you know, strongly agree with. So, and it's not to be black or white, and it's not to say one's bad or nothing. I'm not making it a political statement here. But what I'm saying is, if there were more authenticity in our general sphere and our general public discourse, man, it would be so much better. It would be such a relief. You know, yeah, it may be hard. It may be hard to be authentic, because then what do you do with only two parties? You have to make a third, and you may have to figure out what to do, and you may have to be more responsible. But it sure as hell beats all the deceit and all the, you know, just pushing down and back of
a couple
what we want, just not being listened to.
A lot of government that need to be worked on. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They've totally narrowed it down to just a few things that we're bickering over.
And right.
And everything else we're 100% the same on. Yeah, it's silly.
Yeah, it has gotten quite ridiculous. And I think that the whole answer to this is, you know, just a revitalization of the existentialist movement, man. It's such a powerful movement and such a powerful school of thought that if our universities went back to this instead of the postmodern, you know, neo-Marxist kind of philosophy, if we could forget that materialist look of things and kind of go back to the existentialist view, I think that would be in a lot better shape. And I really wish the best for our universities and our next generation coming up, and that more of these great existentialist thinkers would be promoted, and that we could have a more authentic, a more, you know, honest and open and responsible society, you know, with more freedom of dialogue. And, you know, I think it would be a huge improvement and something that we drastically need right now. So that's kind of why ever since in college, I've gotten into this existentialist school of thought and kind of continue it and continue this own project here. This is my own attempt at patching up things.
Well, you know, I think this type of thing is always good to good to have conversations on. It's good to educate yourselves, you know, because you look at when this story was written and even similar stories, even centuries before, that the problems of humanity all remain the same. It's just now with population growth and everything, it's, you know, and the internet, everything is just in your face. All of our problems can be in your face. And it's, you have to take a step back sometimes and realize, you know, there was a time where we just didn't know what was going on around the world. But that doesn't mean that the same things weren't happening. So now we're aware. Now you have truly, with the internet, the knowledge of good and evil. Every day of your life, you get to see it. And you can choose to look out and see the good, or you can choose to look out and see the bad. I mean, we're all still here. So as of now, most of it's good. So, I guess look for the Inquisitors in your world.
And in yourself.
And in yourself.
Yeah.
And become aware of them.
Well, that's good. We'll leave it at that. I really appreciate it, Jason. You did a great job. And like I said, guys, he did this just reading this for the very first time. I made up a little script and he just read along with me. So hats off to Jason. We appreciate you.
Well, thank you very much. It was good to be here. And maybe we'll do it again.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. This was something I had been looking into doing for a long time, and I've been meaning to get back to this show. I apologize that it's been so long since my last episode. It's such a narrow field of expertise that I got myself into, with just one author and one specific school of philosophy, so it's kind of tough to find guests. And this, you know, little reenactment, if you will, was something I had been looking to do for a long time, kind of update, you know, the Grand Inquisitor, make it more accessible to a modern audience. I don't know if I did that or not. I hope I did. I hope it was enjoyable the way I had written it. You know, there's multiple translations out there, and this is kind of its own unique thing. It's not really even a translation, but, you know, well, what can I say? I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope it speaks for itself. Thank you very much for listening, and hopefully I can get like this Patreon thing going. I don't exactly understand how it works, and hopefully I can get on here more and do this more often, but I'm just a working guy trying to work and, you know, pay for my kids and do all that stuff, so I don't have a whole lot of time to be on here. So thanks again for your patronage, and we appreciate you here at the show.